What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Polititeen. My name is Damien Galvin, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Varun.
Hello, everybody. My name is Varun Katathala. I'm the co-host of the Polititeen podcast, where me and Damien, two high school teens from Georgia, try to have political conversations with individuals of expertise from things like racial justice to climate change to even, you know, sex trafficking, as we're going to talk about today, hopefully. Now, today we have a very special guest with us. His name is Daniel Blackman. He's a candidate for Georgia District 4 Public Service Commission. Now, Daniel, if you'd like to introduce yourself to our guests.
Yeah, man. First of all, honored to be on here, man. Always advocating for young people and for teens and youth to get out there and start the movement and add your voice to conversation. So for those of you that don't know, my name is Daniel Blackman. I am the Democratic nominee for the Public Service Commission in the state of Georgia. They regulate our public utilities. And, you know, I'm a investor by trade. I also do a lot of work in the nonprofit space. I work with a lot of initiatives that need to be funded, such as and work to specifically focus on criminal justice reform. So I'm just happy to be here and happy to get involved with this conversation.
Yeah, definitely. We can tell, and we're happy to have you here. So, you know, as for our first question that we asked to all our guests, what really got you kind of involved in politics, and what makes Daniel Blackman Daniel Blackman?
Yeah, I mean, you know, politics for me, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the passing of Congressman John Lewis and Reverend C.T. Vivian, who are both mentors and friends to me. I got into politics by default. You know, they, at 19 years old, you know, I met these gentlemen that marched with Dr. King, and, you know, they were, you know, building their legacy, and they were doing work that consisted of making sure that young people like myself were engaged in the struggle for civil and human rights. And it just got to a point where, you know, ironically, man, I just kind of give you a perspective I usually don't give people. I started off in the music industry and working in the music industry for Radio One and then for Arista Records and Universal Records. I didn't really have a desire to go into civil and human rights until I learned that our generation, my generation, wasn't as active in the voting space. And that bothered me, man. You know, I felt like if we could get our license at 16 and, you know, go into the military at 18 and, you know, drink at 21 and all these different things, why, you know, when we were young, didn't we have a say in the decisions that impacted our lives? I didn't really put that into perspective until my mid-20s. And, you know, really, to answer your question direct, the catalyst for me getting in politics was the Barack Obama campaign. I worked with Usher, and I worked with a couple of guys that I knew. One of them currently is a part of Black Eyed Peas, and we created these campaigns called I Can't But You Can. And these campaigns basically were just getting young people like yourselves that may not have been a voting age to be able to go out and register their friends and family. And that gave me a lot of gratification. It gave me a lot of hope, and it got me to a point where I said, hey, this is not only feels good, but, you know, I feel like I'm doing something right. And I haven't turned around from that space since. So it's just been a journey, man. And there's an African proverb that says, if you want to run far, if you want to run fast, run alone. If you want to run far, run with others. So I found some good people to support and to work with. And that was 20 years ago, and I'm still in this space.
Right. And you talked about people that inspired you and people you've worked with. You said you worked with Usher as in the singer, correct?
Yeah. So I've worked with a lot of athletes and entertainers, but Usher, I worked with directly through his foundation.
Wow. That's absolutely insane, Mr. Blackman. I think that a lot of us have things to take from idols. I think
Mr. Blackman.
Yeah. There he is.
Okay, there you go.
All right, perfect.
Are you back, Mr. Blackman? Sorry, we lost you there for a second.
Hello, Mr. Blackman? Yeah, I think that he's having technical difficulties.
I'm here.
Awesome.
Are you good? All right, awesome, yeah.
If you can continue your talking point, you left us there for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, all I was saying was that I met an usher when I was, you know, late teens, early 20s. And, you know, it was just one of those things where, you know, being in the right place at the right time, meeting the right people and continuing to do the work. Usher was one of the first artists I ever met. Usher and Alicia Keys were the two artists that I had a chance to support early in my career.
Wow.
And they both had foundations. Alicia had a foundation called Keep a Child Alive, which was a campaign to address HIV and AIDS in Africa. And Usher had and still has a foundation called the New Look Foundation. And he worked with young people to encourage entrepreneurship and mentorship. So, you know, I got involved early, man, and I was attracted to people that use their brand and their celebrity to impact change. And that's a space I've occupied for a long time.
Yeah, it's extremely crucial, and we advocate on the podcast that if you have a platform, you use it, yeah. And if you're not using it, then in many senses, you're not using your platform correctly. Whether you're a singer, whether you're an athlete, despite the accusations, I suppose if you would call them that you might face of you know, the kind of just dribble, shut up and dribble, you know.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You know, despite that, you see, I think true. Patriotism is pushing that to the side and still choosing to advocate for what you believe is right.
Of course,
you know, we just had a conversation earlier today with who was it, Bruin? Sorry, I lost the
Dr.
name.
Roberts, the professor from Stanford.
Yeah, Dr. Roberts, and he said that, you know, we in his final statement to us, he said that if you can't answer the question, what have you done to fight systemic racism, within 5 seconds, then you need to reevaluate what you're doing, right? And after that, me and Bruin had a discussion, and we were like, it's odd that we come and we have these conversations, and we by no means come on every day and we think that we're patriots or that we're heroes. But in retrospect, when you look at the conversations that you're having and you get messages saying that, you know, you're informing America's youth, even though directly that is our intention, it's interesting to look in retrospect and say, hey, with this episode, people told us that they learned this or that. And even though we can't vote, we can educate people who can. And it's a very interesting situation to be in.
But I think with all due respect to what he said, I think people are at different levels, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, we're in Forsyth County, Georgia. You know, race is it's like, think of racial, the comfortability of speaking about race, like, generational wealth, right? Like, wealth is passed down to some people and it's not passed down to others, right? For whatever reason, we can argue systemic racism, we can argue, you know, a variant of issues. But when people at the dinner table, like, I literally just finished talking to my mother, my aunt, and my cousin about entrepreneurship in our community. And, you know, when you don't have conversations about race or justice or equity or voting at your dinner table, then it's hard for you to make the argument or make the case for or against being active or vocal on these issues. So it doesn't mean that you're not doing enough. It just means at times you're uninformed. And we have to bridge those gaps of people being uninformed and people having access to information. And that's a part of the struggle, but it's also a part of the opportunity for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes it's being uninformed, and sometimes it's being pacifist in today's society, being silent.
Of course.
And that is something we've valued or even said time and time again, that silence is complicity. You know, if you're silent and passive about an issue, it means that you're supporting it unintentionally. But I think that conversation is the way forward. Mr. Blackman, I think that having conversations with people who are different than you, have different opinions than you, is the most important thing we can do to bridge that gap between individuals. And I think that is what we try to do here at Politician. It's having these important conversations and giving our viewers an insight into these conversations. Now, I wanted to have a conversation with you, Mr. Blackman, about climate change. And I know you're a huge, huge, huge advocate for climate change. But one of the main issues that we haven't discussed ever on the podcast is the impact of COVID-19 on climate change. Now, when I said it a couple of weeks ago, it was to say that 17% of all daily emissions are decreased because of the amount of COVID-19 tensions we've had in terms of going outside. But the other perspective that I want to ask you about is the fact that President Trump has used COVID-19 as a smokescreen, as I would say, to roll back environmental regulations under the EPA. Now, what do you think about what the president has been doing in terms of hurting the environment to boost the economy in terms of COVID-19? Is it a needed thing in terms of economic reevaluation, or is it really, really stressful to our climate change?
I think it's much deeper than that. The president came in 2017 with an agenda to dismantle and roll back everything that the previous few administrations have done. You know, we may not like what Bush did on oil and gas, and, you know, we may not agree with all of what Obama did, but if you look at what this administration has done, from the EPA, you know, to hiring a lobbyist to run the EPA, a oil and gas lobbyist to run the EPA, to having a gentleman, Ryan Zink, over the Department of Interior, where we're seeing native lands and protected lands being compromised for construction. When we see a U.S. Senate that has not been friendly to the environment, that's rolled back the Stream Protection Act and rolled back regulations that protect our properties and our lands, then those are the much greater issues that we have to think of. But here's the thing to your point about climate change, about what the administration has done, or at least in my perspective, I would like to say has failed to do, and that's to really understand the parallels between COVID-19 and climate change. And those parallels include, you know, and if you, matter of fact, you know, there's a article today that compares, if people think that COVID-19 is bad, then if we were to look at the height of our challenges with climate change, this would seem like a walk in the park. And that's just the reality. If we imagine if you had, you know, 300 days in a row of 90 degree weather, you know, while we're sheltering in place, imagine what that means. You know, and I don't think people have been able to put it into perspective. I don't think people have been able to do the work or to understand how these things affect them on a daily basis. I don't think we understand food scarcity and food shortage, which is exactly what we're facing right now. I don't think that we understand truly to the extent that we are doing the work, understand how low and moderate income families and poor communities that have been impacted by dirty air and by dirty water. I think those are issues. When you look at COVID-19 right now, who is getting COVID-19? And at higher levels, it's blacks and Latinos, and it's also poor whites, poor people in general. Why is that happening? Because of pre-existing conditions. So now the correlation between climate change and COVID-19 makes sense, because if you have, for instance, asthma, which African-American children have asthma 3 times the national rate, if you have it and then you get COVID, well COVID attacks your respiratory system, right? If you already have a breathing issue, then that's a challenge. If you have high blood pressure, if you have diabetes, when you look across the board at the health of the United States, and then you look at why is it that way, right? You mentioned climate change. Well, 68% of African American communities are in proximity to a coal-fired plant. That's not gonna give you better health. So when a pandemic like COVID-19 happens, now you not only have higher health risks and challenges, but you're now faced with issues that are out of your control. So there are many issues to look at it from that perspective, but it's a very deep hole, it's a challenge, and it really, you know, quite frankly, exposes how ill-prepared the United States is. You know, we're a wealthy nation, but when it comes to social equity and when it comes to health and wellness of our citizens, we get an F.
We get a huge F. For claiming to be the best on all fronts, it's very odd that I think we have the worst healthcare system in the world, for a first world country, that is. So, you know, on the local level, I'd like to ask you, what can we focus on to kind of get, you know, be more environmentally sound and be more environmentally friendly? And on the same front, you know, as well as on the local level, obviously all of these ideas play into each other. You know, if you're more environmentally friendly, then you in turn have better health, and therefore the cost of healthcare will go down. But on the same front, what can we do both on the side of environments locally and on the side of healthcare to benefit? You know, I often advocate for health literacy, something that I feel like, even though we might have to a certain respect, we don't enforce as much. You know, we have people saying right now, come in and quarantine, but I don't think that this virus would have, you know, the same lethality if for the past 20, 30 years we had been telling people, don't eat McDonald's every day, be healthier, you know, kind of advocating for that health literacy. So on both fronts, what are things that we can do, not only, you know, maybe not even only on the local level, but literally inside of our homes to promote better, a cleaner environment and better health for all?
Well, the United States' public school system, in my opinion, has been obsolete for at least 30, 40 years. And, you know, if if you want to pull perspective on the United States and how far we are, how far we've come, just look at the global education rankings. You know, we like to poke our chest out and say we've got the strongest military and, you know, we've got the best schools and the best hospitals. But when you look at global literacy, we're not even in the top 20. And that's a problem, you know, when you're so far down the barrel in those areas. So there are three ways to answer that question. The first is from an economic standpoint, we've got to make eating healthy, and we've got to make having access to clean energy affordable. For example, right now, if you were to, let's just say the average family that makes, I don't know, $20,000, right? Because right. 2.9 million people in the state of Georgia live at or below the poverty level. So imagine you have a house of five and you're making $20,000 a year. You're living in poverty, right? Well, it's not fair that it costs $12,000 to $16,000 to put a solar unit on your home, because now, unless you have, you know, a public option for community solar.
Sorry, Mr. Blackman, we're having a difficulty hearing you.
Okay. Hold on.
Awesome. We can hear you again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfect.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So what I was saying was the challenge is that if you look at, there are three ways to really look at it. One is from an affordability standpoint, an economic standpoint. If you can't, for instance, if you live with a family of five and you have, let's say you make $20,000 a year, you're living at below poverty. And if you're living below poverty, your zip code should never determine your ability to have access to clean energy, right? So there's so many indicators, because on average, you've got to pay $12,000 to $16,000 for a solar unit on your house. Well, the average person can't do that, right? So we've got to think of local ways to make it more affordable, to open those opportunities, to open those doors. And then let's be honest, our school systems not only have to teach it better, but look at the lunches we serve our kids. We're saying that we should eat healthy, but I've gone to my son's school, all three of my children's school on more than one occasion, and there haven't been healthy options. So we've got to do a better job in using the infrastructures we have in place to offer better for our children.
Right, right. And I think going upon your previous point, when you answered my question, you talked about how there's certain parallels between COVID-19 and climate change that could happen in the future now, and it's happening right now. Now, the issue that I see right now is that we're talking about, every conservative's argument is that by, we're making a switch towards clean energy, we're alienating young, like, poor people, right? The coal workers and these plant workers. But during, if we have a climate change crisis that's even more than it is right now, in the future, these poor people, these coal workers, are going to be affected the most. That's the issue that I see is happening right now, that we don't recognize that. But in terms of schooling, I have to agree with you, Mr. Blackman, because, you know, this is a personal story anecdote. I'm going off topic here, but in freshman year of high school, I was part of a biology class, right? It was an on-level biology class. I was learning about climate change and environmental issues. It was the first time we'd ever talked about climate change in a school setting. And one of my best friends, he rhetorically, in a more satirical way, asked the teacher, "Do you believe in climate change?" And the teacher, obviously, we all thought he was going to say yes because he was teaching about it. He said no. He said, "I believe that environmental deterioration is happening, but it's not happening because of humans. It's happening naturally." Now, yeah. That was absolutely, you know, it was really, really weird to me, seeing somebody who was teaching me not believe in the science behind things. And I immediately said, where's the science behind that? And he's like, "We'll talk about this later." But we never talked about it. Now, the issue is that we have people like that in our schooling system who don't believe in the science behind these things. And Mr. Blackman, I think my perspective upon this is that people want to have a convenient future. We want to think a certain way because it's convenient to us. But climate change is an inconvenient truth, as Al Gore puts it. And I think that my question to you is, how do we make that inconvenient truth something that we can accept? Because so many conservatives and even some Democrats don't believe in climate change because they don't want to believe in climate change.
Well, I would rephrase that. I don't think it's that they don't want to believe in climate change. I mean, okay. It's clear that there are evidences that exist that would argue against that case. I just don't think it's a priority, okay. Right? Because if you think about it, you know, even with conservatives, right? What do conservatives believe in? They believe in security, right? They believe in fiscal conservatism, right? They believe in, you know, capitalism. So, problem that we have that believe in climate change and that support the science is that we're not speaking the climate language from a capitalism standpoint, right? So when you look at Goldman Sachs, when you look at BlackRock and other financial institutions, they're now divesting from investments in fossil fuels, right? What does that do for the U.S. market? It scales back the amount of companies that are doing fossil fuel investments, oil, gas, those kind of areas, and it encourages more, right? Because now the monies that they manage, trillions of dollars, are now being redirected, right? And so the argument, for instance, a friend of mine did war games with the CIA, and they did a scenario in the Middle East that what would cause the next world war. And the next world war came, would happen as a result of two things happening simultaneously. The first thing is water shortage and a severe famine in at least one-third of the world's population, two-thirds of the world's population. Now, that seems far off and very crazy, but look at what COVID-19 has done to our food supplies. You have our food chain that has been broken. How? Well, the farmers that are sending the food to the factories to be processed, when the factory workers get COVID-19, when the food can't get processed, it doesn't go to Publix, it doesn't go to Kroger, it doesn't go to Whole Foods. So when your food chain is broken, it causes bigger issues. Look at the bomb that just went off in Beirut. 70% of the food supply in Beirut comes from a single port that exists in the very area where the blast happened. So when you look at global water shortages, and when you look at the fact that the United States is one-fifth of the global population, but we are literally, we're 5% of the global population, but 25% of the contributors to global waste and climate change.
Yeah.
So when you look at it from those perspectives, the urgency has to begin to change, because we're not doing ourselves a service. And then lastly, there's a quote that the United Nations made that I stand on every day when I talk about climate, which says we are well able to meet the needs of the present without compromising future generations to meet their own needs. We've made the decisions within our past several generations that are unfortunately compromising the opportunity for your generation to make the decisions that are necessary for your survival.
Yeah, and you know, bringing up Beirut, I just want to say, my portion of the profits from our Patreon this week or this month that you can check out at patreon.com/politatinepodcast, they will be going to a foundation that is going to help the situation that happened in Beirut. And I advise, obviously we're still a small podcast, so it's not going to be much, but I advise all of our listeners to do the same and to go and donate whatever they can to help that situation. But obviously, staying on domestic politics here, in the county, in Forsyth itself, we had an article come out. It was I think it was a guest columnist, I think that you would say, it come out, I believe, earlier today, coming from our superintendent. And it mentioned, it outlined the reasons for the schools being reopened. Again, not to kind of lean back on our Patreon, but if you guys have questions for the superintendent, we have an interview coming up here in 5 days with him. Be sure to check out the Patreon. That's the best way that you can get your questions to us. But with that being said, there's a lot of counterattacks to that. But one of the things that stood out to me the most was when he mentioned the homeless population within Forsyth County, and specifically. Earlier today, we also had a tragic instance with a Denmark high school football player, lost both parents to COVID-19, and is now.
Dustin Hunter.
Thank you. Yeah, Dustin Hunter. He lost both parents to COVID-19, and if I'm not mistaken, is now homeless.
Right.
And due to those circumstances, I don't know if this article was written before this happened or after. But he says that 600 children within Forsyth County are homeless, and 100 of those, I don't remember the exact phrasing that he used, but are homeless and don't have any parents. So
yeah, it's a big number.
It's a huge number. But do you think that number is going to grow with the policies that are being enacted to reopen the schools? Because if we just saw one student lose both of his parents and become homeless, and at the same time, later in the day, we saw Dr. Bearden use the argument, that very argument, that he wants to support those children as a means of reopening the school to the very virus that his parents died from.
Well, yeah, and I'll say this, first of all, I'm going to give kudos to Forsyth County for being prepared in a sense of online learning, because One of the things that I'm running on my platform is access to high-speed internet and wireless broadband. And I have three children that are currently in the Forsyth County public school system. And they have been able, on snow days and through COVID-19 over the last 3 months, they have been able to keep up. Mm-hmm. And the kids that are getting left behind are the kids, like you mentioned, the homeless kids. But when you think about rural areas in Georgia, when you think about areas that don't have access to high-speed internet or wireless broadband, that can't listen to an amazing and informative show like this, that's where your problem comes in. So that's my kudos. My challenge and my pushback to Mr. Bearden and to the entirety of our county is leadership is not just about sound bites and having information. It's about action. And we haven't seen action from, you know, let's be honest, many of our conservative areas that are more afraid of the argument of a person's personal freedoms than the health and well-being of the community. Now, here's the short answer to your question. From a national perspective, homelessness is going to most certainly go up. As a matter of fact, moratoriums on evictions, and for those that don't know what a moratorium is, it's a period of time where no one can be evicted. And when COVID-19 hit, there was a moratorium on utility disconnections and evictions, which meant that no one in Georgia and around the United States could have their power cut off or they could not get kicked out of their home. Well, that all ends within the next 60 days. So there are 23 million Americans as of this conversation right now that are at risk by the end of August to be homeless. 23 million. Now, I don't know what that number is for the state of Georgia, but if you scale that back to a county like Forsyth County, we're the fastest growing county in Georgia, seventh wealthiest county in the United States, fastest growing Indian population. We've got all these good things going for us, but the challenge is now for those workers that are undocumented, for those who work in our chicken plants, for the poor families that live in trailer homes. We have trailer parks here in Forsyth County. So poverty is definitely an issue, specifically in the northern part of our county. Now we run into the issue of opening our schools and having a balance between schools opening and the option of online learning versus now access, right? The access mm-hmm. part is the biggest challenge, because if you're a single mom or a single dad and you work at a retail location, or you work as a bartender or a server, well, you can't afford to miss your job to stay home and work with your kids. So the balance isn't the argument I'm making with the schools, it's the lack of accountability as it relates to the safety, the health, and the well-being of our teachers and our students, and specifically the lack of requiring a mask, as we've seen in Cherokee County, we've seen it at Paulding High School, mm-hmm. we've seen students that are now being suspended, teachers that are now being threatened to lose their jobs. So we've got to really address the writing on the wall, which is the lack of transparency and leadership on making hard decisions, like putting on a mask, making it mandatory.
Right. And you talk about, you know, we're well able to meet the needs of, you know, the present without compromising the next generation. In this standpoint, we are the next generation. Our students yes, are the next generation. And by compromising them, by not mandating masks, you're doing exactly that. You're compromising us. And that's yes. what, you know, by you saying that quote, I believe that you're completely against mandate. You know, you think that we should mandate masks within Forsyth County. But I think that the bigger issue is...
Let me be clear, because that word mandate is a divisive word that too often people feel they're being forced into something. The argument is not about forcing people to do something or not. It's about making sure that we ensure the health and the safety and the well-being of everyone. If you are coming to school, there should be a requirement of wearing a mask, not because we want to infringe on your personal ability to make your own choice, but because we want to protect the health and well-being of those around you. And it's clear, because we've seen a class, I believe, in Cobb County of yeah. second graders that now have to quarantine. 28 second graders quarantining because one second grader caught COVID-19 and potentially infected other kids who may have elderly parents at home, siblings, and now they become somewhat of a vehicle of transmitting a virus, and we can't have that happen.
Yeah, definitely.
That.
And
I saw that as well.
Go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say that I saw that as well, and I think that the issue right now is that the responsibility is not being taken by anybody. We have to ensure that people are focusing upon our school system and the kids of our future. I think that we're going to have Dr. Bearden on next Wednesday, the 12th of August, I believe, and that's the day before school reopens. And I'm going back to school. You know, if considering it doesn't close, for how long it happens. Now, I think that I am not going to be feeling safe in my shoes going to school. I'm going to be social distancing, but my friends will not. And seeing people catch COVID-19 is going to be really, really, really stressful. Really, really a bad thing to see right now. And back to the idea of you know, taking responsibility and prioritizing things, climate change is the exact same phenomenon. We're not prioritizing certain things, and we're prioritizing other things. And just before we go into this whole school thing, I wanted to make one stance upon climate change. I think that a capitalist standpoint, explaining it in terms of capitalism, is extremely, extremely essential. Our carbon tax, in my perspective, is essential. We have to bridge the gap between climate change as an ideology into climate change as a capitalist mindset. Carbon tax and carbon exchange do that, in my perspective.
It does, and I'll say this really, really quickly. I think to go even further, you know, we just don't teach that. And when I made the comment earlier that our public school system has been obsolete for the past 40, 50 years, is because we've literally taught from the same perspective without looking at the opportunities and the trends that can have a positive impact. If we were able to, you know, have a simple space that we can talk about capitalism and the economy and economics in general, then I think interjecting the way impacts such as extreme weather and climate change impact us every day and impact our wallets, that is an area that I believe it may not happen with the current leadership, but it will happen over time with the next generation. Right. There's a quote that says it's hard for a man to understand a thing when his salary depends on him not understanding it, right? In other words, when you're working a job for a check, you're not interested in who it impacts or affects. But when you work that position because of your responsibility to society, that's when we have change makers, and that's your generation when you graduate from college and go into the workforce.
Let me say one quick thing, Damon, before we continue here. This is obviously a very passionate thing for me, but I think that you're absolutely right in that some coworkers, they're like, oh, I'm going to lose my job because of a green economy. The fact of the matter is you're going to lose your job either way. The coal industry has been declining for the past couple of decades. You know, you can't stop that decline. I think that we have to explain that in terms of capitalism. You're going to lose your job either way, but you're going to gain another job if we do convert to a green economy over time. It has to be gradual, and that's my last point before we go into this whole school thing, Damien.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, before we jump into the school thing, a quick message from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Mr. Blackman. All right, awesome. How are you enjoying the conversation so far? Okay, and we're back. We're on the conversation of schooling, and one big front, you know, we were talking about school being obsolete, but one thing that we talk about here a lot on the podcast, and that we mentioned, I'm pretty sure listeners are tired, or our viewers are tired of listening to this, but it's financial literacy. And I feel like in terms of financial literacy, the school system has failed more, I would say, disproportionately people who are financially illiterate, therefore minorities. Everything that I've learned about you know, in terms of finance has more so been outside of school. And, you know, I come home to, you know, two immigrant parents, and I kind of explain these things to them, and they're like, that's how taxes work. Like, you know, it's interesting to see in a certain respect that on certain fronts that I can be more educated than them, but it's unfortunate that I'm gaining that education from an outside source than the primary source that I think many people would assume that you should be getting it from.
Agreed.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that we do ourselves a disservice to have kids that go into college without a real understanding and a complete understanding of financial literacy, which then translates into massive student debt. And then you go into you start off life without being able to pursue your dreams, take vacations, or, you know, start your own companies. And that's, you know, let's be honest, not everyone has the luxury or the opportunity or the discipline to make that transition. But when you have it, and this is a lesson I would give younger people listening, imagine graduating from college with $100,000 debt. You're going to be paying that off for a long time. And imagine if you meet someone, say, you know, 2 or 3 years after you You get out of college and you want to get married, right? And they bring their $50,000. Now you got $150,000 debt, right? So how do you buy your first car? How do you buy your first home? How do you get married and put yourself in a position where you can build a family and you can build wealth? So we're not doing a good enough job of preparing our society physically, mentally, and financially as it relates to being in the real world. And that is why so many generations repeat the vicious cycle of poverty.
Right. And I have the luxury of having a grandpa who talks to me every day about financial literacy and why it's so important for me to know how I deal with my finances. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, for example, an African-American child in a low-income community has a grandpa who's probably working a day job, who doesn't have that same kind of luxury that I do. I think that the schools teaching that would be absolutely phenomenal because it gives everybody the same opportunity and levels the playing field even more. Because right now, it is most definitely not a level playing field. Now, the issue in which I wanted to talk to you about, Mr. Blackman, in terms of financial literacy, because you're big on human trafficking and sex trafficking for that matter. Now, the issue right now is the people who lose that kind of money or in debt, they go towards opportunities to gain that quick cash, which sometimes is human trafficking. But the issue of the matter right now is that with COVID-19, we have 75% of NGOs closed for the year. We have really no support system for these people, and more importantly, the economy is failing. It's a recession. So we have more and more and more human trafficking. This is what human traffickers prey upon, this economic status. So, I mean, I think that financial literacy more specifically plays into human trafficking than anything else. Do you think it has a role to play? And even COVID-19, it's just kind of a broad subject.
Well, I mean, you know, I have a very personal story, as you may know, about human trafficking. That's my goddaughter is a survivor. She was trafficked for 4 years in the metro Atlanta region. Atlanta is number 2 or 3 in the United States, according to FBI data, for our human trafficking, combination of our thoroughfares of travel, including our airport, our transit system. We have Amtrak, we have Greyhound, and we have at least 4 major interstates, I-285, I-20, 75, and 85. So when you put all those things in perspective, and then you look at victims of what I would consider circumstance, that's when, to your point, vulnerability kicks in. And the most of the populations that go in, for instance, and I'm just going to be very frank on this conversation, but most young women that think that they may want to go into adult entertainment, they make a decision thinking that they're going to pay their way through school or they're going to make a couple extra money and buy a car, and then they get put into this vicious cycle that is, in many senses, inescapable. And I don't think anyone goes into any space to be trafficked, whether it's human trafficking or sexual assault in any space. However, we, again, don't do a good enough job of opening those doors. And here's the biggest problem. Here's why human trafficking, drug sales, drug abuse, gun trafficking, gang violence, here's why all of those things are going to go up. And I hate to put it to you like this, but here's something I want your viewers to think about, your listeners and viewers to think about. Within the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see an economy that increases by about 80% to automation, meaning the truck jobs, the retail jobs. There was a time where when I was a kid, when I was 16, I can go get a job at McDonald's or Burger King. Well, now kiosks are taking your order. I could have bagged groceries up until I was 18 or 19. But you know what? Now when you go to Kroger, you go to Publix, you got a machine, you put your money in so they don't need it. So now that those simple jobs that you don't need a high school degree for, you don't need to have completed collegiate education, now we're going to see folks that are going to really be in survival mode. Wow. The most dangerous part of humanity is when we go from being civil and human and global citizens to doing whatever it takes to survive and feed our families. And that goes back to the point you made earlier about if we would have made decisions earlier to help kids eat right, we wouldn't have the obesity, the cancer problems, the diabetes problems that we have today. But because we didn't make those investments 20 years ago, we overinvested into pharmaceuticals, fast foods, and the beverage lobbyists of the world. Now we're going to have a full-on challenge that, in my opinion, is going to be irreparable. Because after COVID is passed and things get more competitive and we try to work in many areas, what do we do? You know, what do we do for folks that are struggling to pay their bills? What do we do for people that are struggling to keep the lights on? So we've got a lot of things we've got to look at and a lot of problems we're going to have to solve in a fairly short amount of time.
Yeah, no, definitely. This kind of wraps back into the whole school conversation that we were having. But when you go from thriving to surviving, some people get very desperate and get very desperate very, very quickly, especially when you have a family to support. So the odd paradox here is that you reopen schools. You know, I've said on the podcast, and I think I said it with Mr. Bosky, who was on the podcast earlier, but I said it with him. Yeah, he's an amazing man. He's a man of many talents.
Yes,
But
he's the white
but
Donald Glover, as we say.
That's but with that being said, you know, the responsibility of the county and of the school system is to is primarily to keep the children safe, the children that they are entrusted to safe. So it's not to function as a daycare, right? So, but you also have this paradox where it is a daycare in this circumstance with COVID-19 is a petri dish because you have kids that don't know how to take care of themselves. Not even that don't know. Some of them are just ignorant to the fact that wearing a mask is the right thing to do. Others are, you know, 6 years old and can't keep a mask on even if they were the most intelligent child at the time. But you have this kind of paradox where it's you send them back to school, they come home, they you know serve as vehicles for the virus to their parents go to work, everyone at the work gets sick, the job has to close down. So now this hope that you are working as a daycare in order to you know have make sure that the parents have a job, it kind of closes that kind of a that line of that thought process, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I agree with you. I think that there are a number of indicators that that have an impact there, and we're going to have to deal with them. So you're spot on, man. I mean, I've just not too much I can add to the statement that you just made. I mean, we've got several challenges, and again, I just reiterate the fact that you know you guys are going to be in a very, very unique position. The greatest parts of our history, if you look at the civil and human rights period in the United States. Out of that period came great opportunities and great change. Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend C.T. Vivian, Congressman John Lewis, Andrew Young, these individuals sacrificed a significant part of their lives. But the people we don't hear about are the 16 and 17-year-olds that were marching, the 16 and the 17-year-olds that were doing sit-ins, the 16 and 17-year-olds that were doing freedom rides. Those are the individuals that sacrificed the going to the dances and going to the parties and hanging out. You know, these young men and women put their lives on the front line every day. And, you know, I'm saying this is a challenge to your show and to your listeners. You guys are going to have to sacrifice a lot to put us back on track to be a successful nation and to be a more, you know, harmonious world. You know, without your generation, I mean, I'm 41. I feel great. I've got three children. I'm going to continue to do amazing work. But you know, 40, 50 years from now, I'm going to probably be gone. And that means that they're going to have to be folks that step up to the plate. And I believe platforms like this educate, inform, but then also have an opportunity to
Yeah,
call to
definitely.
action.
And even though you state it as a sacrifice, you know, in a sense, maybe from the outside looking in, it might be seen as a sacrifice. And obviously, we can't relate to the freedom fighters or you know, in any sense to the movement in the '60s, as you know, being teenagers and relating to teenagers back
I
then.
would disagree with you, man. I think you can
Yeah.
because if you look at '68 and the '60s, y'all generation with the Black Lives Matter movement. With racial equity, with the police issues, with the Trump era. I mean, you guys are just as significant as that era. But 40, 50 years from now, they'll be talking about what was done in the period
Yeah.
that we're living in right
Yeah,
now.
hopefully. And on that front, however, I want to say that you know, I don't see it as a sacrifice. I genuinely I get joy knowing it's odd, you know, again, from a teenager stance, you might only see it as for yourself, but I get joy knowing that future generations, no matter, you know, even if this, I've said it multiple times, even if this podcast only changes one person's viewpoint or one person's ideology on a certain stance, I get joy knowing that future generations might benefit from that. So, you know, the sacrifices that I might be making right now, you know, for example, not having my girlfriend over right now because I'm filming a podcast, not having my girlfriend over tonight because I'm going to be editing stuff for the podcast, making different movements. You know, we have different initiatives here at Politine. You know, for example, I was talking to Varun about this. we want to do either on Valentine's Day or on Christmas. I personally wanted to do, and I know that Varun can help me greatly with this. For Valentine's Day specifically, I wanted to go to low income communities and give gifts to the mothers, to the single mothers, and give gifts to the fathers and the single fathers who are often overlooked. But even it's interesting because, you know, some people might argue that Valentine's Day is just a form of capitalism and it's just to get people to buy things. But those gestures are sometimes something that we take for granted. The gestures that we can buy our mothers flowers, that we can buy our wives flowers, that you know, that we can give each other gifts. It's something that we take for granted. And such a tiny gesture can really be the thing that pushes someone to keep going. So although I might be sacrificing, you know, I told my girlfriend, I was like, this Christmas, I don't want you to get me anything. I want you to go down to low-income communities with me, and I want you to help me give gifts to kids. That's all I want. Even though I might be sacrificing a Christmas gift, I am truly gaining so much more in the sense of joy and in the sense that I know that these kids are going to get so much more from my small sacrifice.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are spot on, man. And that's something that a lot of people don't have, man. I mean, I have tried to raise my children the way my mother and father raised me. And that's to, you know, do everything in your power to take what you've learned and what was instilled in your household and to implement that as an adult. And I think that you guys are right, man. I mean, you know, when my children were very young, we took them once a month to a homeless shelter, and we always kept them grounded. No matter how successful we were, no matter what opportunity opened, what door opened, we always made sure that our children knew that you have something that many people don't have access to. It's a family, it's opportunity, it's access. And so we're at a point in our lives where, you know, it's very important for the next generation, similar to what you just said, to think about what they can do, right? For the Dustins of the world that lose their parents, for the kids, these 600 kids that are apparently homeless. I mean, at the end of the day, the most selfless act you can make is being considerate about someone else that has nothing to do with your success or your progress. Being willing to just show up to the single mom and the single dad, like you said, or to the kid that doesn't have a gift on Christmas, or to the suicidal kid that, you know, feels like no one likes him or wants to talk to him, so they're going to take their life on Valentine's Day. I mean, you never know why, you know, your action is needed in the moment that you live in. And there, we're seeing increased levels of depression.
Yeah.
We're seeing increased levels of anxiety and consideration of suicide.
Yeah.
We're seeing so many parallels, and there are no outlets for discussion. We're not socially interacting. We're not hugging people. And I'm not trying to sound cheesy. I'm just literally saying that there's literally a term called touch deprivation.
Right.
And that term basically says that over time, if humans aren't touching, talking, or interacting, it causes a severe state of depression. So we're literally living in times where people don't have access to humanity because they're just not in a space where they're sharing that space and they're not being offered it by anyone else. So I applaud you for what you just said, and I hope more people take on to what you said and replicate that in their own lives.
Right. Right, and we're in a period, like you said, psychologically, like talking about psychology and how we have Dr. Roberts on, you know, this Monday. The fact of the matter is that it's a psychological concept that, you know, when you don't have that touch, you lose that kind of sense of you're with people, right? Now, so many people are afflicted by that. It's not just something we're saying. It's scientific, and you're absolutely right. I think that going back on Damien's point about sacrifice, what inspires me to start Politicine, do Politicine every single day. Like, I don't know if you guys know this, but we've been on the podcast, on a conversation ever since 3 o'clock. Like, I woke up at 1, did some research. You know, I was on at 3 o'clock. Me and Damien have been talking from 3 to 7 o'clock. And that's because, for me at least, I think it's a little bit for Damien as well. It's the fact that I know that one person is suffering right now, at least one person. And by raising awareness to his or her condition, we're doing something for future generations. And that's what I think drives me. It's that sense of purpose. And I think talking about depression, talking about mental illnesses, I think that a lot of these mental illnesses are caused because people don't have that sense of purpose. So I think that once you have that sense of purpose in your life, you can really, really, really confront these issues. But staying grounded is something I did want to talk about today, Mr. Blackman. The fact of the matter is that a lot of people don't have conversations with people of different races, different ethnicities, and they don't know about people in poorer conditions. They're always stuck up in this sense of, oh, I'm part of this race. I'm part of this privileged kind of wealth class, and that's what I'm always going to be a part of. How important do you think having tough conversations with people who are, you know, less fortunate than you is to bridging the gap between wealth, bridging the gap between race, and bridging the gap between sexuality?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, sometimes my answers are not always the most politically correct answer. I think it's important, but I don't think it's everyone's responsibility, because I learned very early in my career that anything a person can be talked into, they can be talked out of.
Yeah.
So unless a person is convicted, right? And I want to be very clear with what I'm saying. I don't think it's anyone's personal responsibility to reach out to the next person or to reach out to someone else if it's not in their heart,
right?
Because a lot of times the reason why racism persists so much is because we too often, even when we know people are wrong, we challenge people rather than having a dialogue. And even in dialogue, we're in such a politically, you know, polarized time in our country that it's hard to have those conversations. In my office, I have a saying on my wall that says that an individual should listen to understand and not to respond. Why? Because too often we're having conversations to make an argument to prove our point rather than just understand the other person's perspective. Like when I hear people say all lives matter, well,
right,
the example I give to people when you talk about things like that is if you're in a neighborhood that has 400 houses, and 100 houses are on fire, you don't send the fire trucks to the other 300 houses because there's no smoke and there's no fire. So to try and argue someone till I'm blue in the face about why we say Black Lives Matter or why we're concerned about this because of the racial, social, and emotional implications that have happened at higher numbers. We're not saying that white people haven't gotten killed by the police. We're not saying that white people don't struggle with opioids. We're saying, look, let's treat it the same way. When it was crack cocaine in the 80s, Black folks were incarcerated. When it was a problem, and now that it's opioids, we have money for help, money for support, and we're putting programs in place, right? When it was gang violence in the 90s, when I was growing up, we incarcerated. As a matter of fact, Democrats passed the crime bill overwhelmingly. So, and now that we're seeing more challenges with young white kids that are in suburban areas that are facing criminal charges in many areas, such as gang violence and, you know, different types of assault, we're seeing diversion programs. So when we say things like Black Lives Matter, or we say, you know, things like defund the police, which literally means let's stop overfunding, over policing of low-income communities, and let's start increasing our capacity to invest into parks, into after-school programs, into lunch programs, into other areas. So I think it's important for us to speak to the hearts of people, and hopefully our speech and our conversation can encourage people to find it in their own hearts to make decisions that reach out to other people that may be in a different situation or may not have the same opportunities.
Right, and you're 100% right about everything you just said. I want to say one thing before Damien continues on this questioning, but the fact of the matter is that we're so focused upon policing that we fail to institute reform. Like back when Reagan was president, we put in so many policies in the war on drugs to increase policing, to increase these policing of Black communities, low-income communities especially. The fact of the matter is there was not a single policy during his administration that had reform with it. Whereas countries like
which administration was this?
The Reagan administration, the war on drugs.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and so
in the 80s.
Yeah, and countries like Portugal in the same time period decriminalized all drugs and increased reform programs, and they actually improved. But the United States has never improved. And before Damien continues, once again, my last point here is that talking about powder and crack cocaine, I've always mentioned this. The fact of the matter is that crack cocaine is more prevalent in Black communities, whereas powder cocaine is more prevalent in white communities. They're the same chemical compound. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, powder cocaine has less worse consequences than crack cocaine does because of the people that use it. And that's something that cannot stand in today's nation.
And on top of that, and then we can move on from it, but on top of that, you know, when you look at immigration right now, you mentioned Reagan. Our immigration policies, when you look at Trump wanting to be tough on the gang problem, like MS-13, you know what I mean? And I'm totally against gang violence, but, you know, we have to be honest. U.S. policies in Central America and in South America is really, you know, one of the indicators of why we're in the position we're in. When we focused on regime change, when we were doing the war on drugs, and we were actually helping those organizations and those institutions to not helping directly, but when the U.S. government was turning a blind eye to violence that was going on in areas that we were not intervening in and we had political interest in, like, these are all indicators that get us to the place we're in. You can't throw a rock at a glass window and break it and then expect someone else to fix it, and you have no accountability. And that's what's been happening in our country, where the rocks that we've thrown, unfair and unbalanced sentencing, the rocks we've thrown that have kept people in poverty, the rocks we've thrown that have pointed fingers at people, have kept us in the situation we're in.
Yeah, and if we want to talk about one damning rock, we can talk about the kids that are being held in what, you know, cages in at the border. And yep. We talk about this on the podcast. These are homegrown terrorists. These are going to be the next terrorists. These are going to be the next people that hate America from our own policies. And you know, we've seen it in the past where our policies do develop terrorists, but we've never had it in the sense that it was homegrown. And these are kids being – they're not on the other side of the border. They're not in Mexico. They're in the United States being bred as terrorists, and it's leading to a very unfortunate circumstance, and again, something that the next generation is going to have to deal with, something that the next generation is going to have to reckon with. But do you have any commentary on that, on the homegrown terrorists that we're really making here in the United States?
Well, I would go further than that. I mean, I think, you know, we tend to point at black and brown communities of homegrown terrorists being born, but, you know, we got to talk about young white kids that have been, you know, shooting up schools. You know, let's be honest, you can't just take one. You look at Timothy McVeigh, you look at a lot of these individuals that were doing this work. But to your point specifically, I agree with you. You know, when you look at ISIS, most people that don't follow world affairs or foreign policy, when I was in high school, we had Desert Storm, and we had both George H.W. Bush and we had George W. Bush. We had Bill Clinton with Obama, Osama bin Laden set a bomb off at the USS Cole. And, you know, we had so many issues that happened. So as a result, when George W. Bush was in office and we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we have spent, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, I think almost $3 trillion on war. When you look at it, where did ISIS come from? Well, ISIS was the kids that in the 90s, in the early 2000s, prior to 9/11, those were the kids that lost their fathers and their grandfathers and their uncles. So right. We literally displaced it. Now, what do you see in most low-income communities, not just in the black community? When you incarcerate black fathers and brown fathers and white fathers, then the young men, and this is a proven statistic from the Department of Health and Human Services, the FBI, everything, the data shows that when you remove that space, when you remove that figure from especially young men, the end result is what you just said. They grow up, and we can call it homegrown terrorism, or we can call it, you know, these kids are growing up with resentment and anger and hatred, and it's going to come out somewhere or someplace. So to your point, these kids that are being displaced, I agree with you. They might not go and blow up buildings, or, you know, they might not go in and break things, but they will grow up with a resentment against the United States, against the United States' policies, and I think it works out of our favor to have generations of young people that are not getting a fair shot and are being treated very inequitably. So it's a lot that goes into that answer, but we're going to see the repercussions sooner than later.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we have a 70% displaced. The issue is when you're talking about the displacement of America's youth, it's the fact that it's 70% in African American and minority communities. So the issue here comes. The issue isn't just the father being incarcerated. The issue is all the fathers in the neighborhood being incarcerated.
Yeah.
Because then you lose the true male role model. Whereas in a white community, you might have, you know, a father go to prison for a white collar crime.
Yeah. The grocery store owner, the lawyer, the attorney, the insurance guy, the roof guy, everybody, you know. In most of our communities, that, and I can say this as a black man, you know, we don't have as many examples, you know, that, like, for instance, in Forsyth County, in my neighborhood alone, I have a football coach at a high school. I have at least 10 or 15 entrepreneurs. You know, I live in a predominantly white neighborhood, you know, and there is success in every household. And then if you go down to the collection, or you go to House Yana, or you go anywhere in our community, you continuously see that. Well, in most low-income communities, not just with black folks, the heroes of the communities are athletes and entertainers. So there, when you take out fatherhood out of those communities, and case in point, 24 million children in the United States live without their biological father. So when you take out a father figure, when you take out an entrepreneur, when you take out a doctor, a lawyer, or an attorney, then now you have a space where not only are the fathers not there, but the examples are gone as well.
Right.
Yes, definitely.
And, you know, we're running over time here because you have a meeting, obviously, at 7:30. But I wanted to bring up one last point. And one of the podcasts on this question, but before I ask the question, one of the most important things that I've noticed is that black women are not talked about enough. Because when a black man is incarcerated or put in jail for something that he did, these black women in these communities, they have to deal with kids who don't have a dad. You know, it's a very, very hard thing when you don't recognize these women along the same standpoint. But one last question for you, as we ask all of our guests, is do you have any quote, saying from yourself or somebody else that you have to say to America's youth, summarize today's podcast and your political standpoints?
Yeah, I have two of them that I use all the time, and I'm going to use again today. The first one is from Frederick Douglass. He said, "It's better to raise strong boys than to repair broken men." That quote is very important to me because if we don't begin to raise, support, and nurture strong children, young boys and young girls, then we're going to have to repair them at some point. And I'd rather build strong relationships now than have to worry about a person's well-being or mental health later. And then the last quote I'll give you is from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He said, "The true measure of a man is not where he stands in times of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy." So what that means is that, you know, it's easy when everything is good, when COVID is not around, when your grades are good, when there's money in the bank, when everybody's healthy. It's really easy to make decisions and to be who you are and to say you've done your part. The challenge in our country and around the world is when everything is not right, when everything is against you, when there are obstacles and there are challenges and there are adversity, who are you at the lowest state? And I think that many of us have hit a very challenging time with COVID-19 and with the changes we've made from not being at work and not being at school and not being around the people we love as much as we would like. But again, the true measure is not where we are in times of comfort and convenience, where we are in challenge and controversy. So in these challenging times, I would challenge everyone to make up in their mind that they are going to be on the front line of socially transforming us and making this a better society over this time, so that we can heal, we can be stronger, and that our nation, our country, our people, and the people around this world can be better for all of humanity. So I thank you all for the opportunity, and I thank you for allowing me to be on the show, and I will hope that we can continue to be in communication and support each other.
Yes. Absolutely. And with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, the only way that we're going to get through these challenges are together. So be sure to have conversations, uncomfortable conversations, whether it's at the dinner table, over the phone, in person. Make sure that you're progressing your ideas, that you're understanding of different people and how they are and why they are who they are. But with that being said, Ed, we want to thank Mr. Blackman for joining us on the podcast. As always, I want to thank Varun for his insight and his amazing questions. And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another episode of Polititeen. Be sure to tune in this Friday for another episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Awesome.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Polititeen podcast. As always, we appreciate and thank you for your support over these past couple of weeks as we've grown as a podcast and as a duo between myself and Damien. And please follow us on Twitter at Polititeen Show. And always, as always, make sure to follow us on Instagram at Polititeen Show and to connect with us via email at polititeenpodcast@gmail.com. Make sure to check out our newly hosted website at polititeenpodcast.com. And lastly, please consider becoming a sponsor, a donor for our campaign on Patreon. You can get a link to that through our website at www.politicianpodcast.com. And through becoming a sponsor, you can get some amazing exclusive perks, such as a way to contact us for questions, suggestions, becoming part of our exclusive community where you can kind of talk about your political viewpoints and ask questions of our guests as they come on, you know, live streams of us talking, and even posters, stickers to rep Politicine. So as always, have a great rest of your day, and thank you so much for your support over these past couple of weeks. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much.